Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/try.
Hello and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. The sun beats down on a sweltering New York City during one of the hottest summers anyone can remember. New Yorkers are tense. They're sick of the exhausting heat that they endure by sitting on their porches, fanning themselves, watching kids play in the ditches and the fire hydrants. They are eagerly awaiting August, which means the temperatures will finally start to fall. The days seem long, with the sun staying up until almost 9 o'clock. The people look forward to sunset and the relief from the heat that the nighttime will bring. As soon as the sun sets, the discos fill up with people starting to party until the heat starts all over again. The night is seen as a welcome respite. But soon, their feelings about nightfall will change rapidly when a killer begins stalking the streets, murdering young people who venture out in the night. This is the story of the serial killer known as Son of Sam. Let's get into it. Sometimes it feels like serial killers didn't exist before the 1970s. There are so many stories of serial killers from that era that they seem to have sprung up out of nowhere, but that isn't the case. Serial killers have always existed. The truth is that law enforcement became much more sophisticated in the 1950s and the 1960s, and by the 1970s, they were much more adept at spotting a certain type of criminal that at that point had no official title, but soon would. Of all of the stories of serial killers in the 1970s, the Son of Sam stands alone because of the power this killer held. He grabbed one of the toughest cities in the world and held it in his clutches for over a year. July 29th, 1976. Two women, Jody Valenti and Donna Laria, both just 18 years old, are sitting in Valenti's double-parked Oldsmobile when a man approaches the car. Without saying a word, without robbing the women, without any type of interaction whatsoever, he pulls out a gun and fires three bullets. Donna is killed instantly. Jody is hit in the thigh and begins screaming. The shooter simply turns and walks away. Jody tells authorities that her attacker was a white man in his 30s, about 5'8" tall and about 200 pounds, with short, dark, curly hair. Police figure this is a random act. New Yorkers read the articles in the paper and shake their heads about the crime in the city. Donna Laurier's family is outraged, but for the most part, the city moves on quickly. Donna is buried, Jody Valenti recovers, and that was that. During this same era, people were fed up with the crime rate in New York City. A citizen group of vigilantes forms and calls itself the Guardian Angels. I grew up as a small town girl, even, knowing exactly what those red caps meant. You saw them all the time on the news. They weren't cops, but the cops kind of let them go and do what they wanted. The good cops actually needed their help. The Guardian Angels were tough guys that weren't afraid of a fight, and they patrolled the subways and streets in an attempt to dissuade crime. And there's a lot of evidence that their presence really did help. But I bring them up not because they have a big involvement in this case, but to show just how bad the crime rate was back then. Bad enough to bring New Yorkers together in this group that called themselves the Guardian Angels to fight it. People were really fed up with the crime. October 23rd, 1976. Carl Denaro, age 20, and Rosemary Keenan, age 18, are sitting in a parked car in a residential area of Flushing, Queens. A man walks up to the car, says nothing, takes nothing, but pulls out a gun and fires his weapon. Carl is struck in the head. Both Carl and Rosemary survive. In fact, Rosemary is not even hit by the gunfire. But neither of them get a good look at the shooter, and they cannot offer a description. A few cops remember the shooting of Jody and Donna from a few months earlier, and there's a little bit of talk about whether or not the two shootings could be connected. One of the cops says, "Carl has really long hair. He kind of looks like a girl from the back." Could be the killer thought it was two girls in the car. November 27th, 1976. In a quiet suburban neighborhood of Queens that is not really part of the crime wave sweeping New York City, two girls, Donna DeMasi, age 16, and Joanne Lomino, age 18, arrive at home about 12:30 a.m. after a late movie. As they walk to the porch of their homes and are saying goodnight, a man dressed in military fatigues approaches them. The man begins talking to them, but he's acting kind of strangely, and the girls begin to walk away from him. As they turn to walk away, the man pulls out a small revolver. He shoots Donna in the neck and Joanne in the back. Donna DeMasi recovers from her wounds. Joanne Lomino is left paralyzed by hers. Again, the police assume this is an isolated incident and it is not tied to the other shootings. January 13, 1977. John Deal, age 30, and his fiancée, Christine Friend, age 26, are sitting in John's car in Flushing, Queens. They had come from a movie, but had to park about four blocks from the theater because parking was not available any closer. Suddenly, the passenger window exploded. John heard three shots and saw Christine slump over. So John throws the car into gear and drives away, but he hears another shot and runs into something as he tries to help Christine. She is taken to the hospital, where she dies around 4:30 that morning. John is not able to give the police a very good description of their attacker. For the first time, authorities make a public acknowledgement that this attack has similarities to the previous attacks, and they inform the public that all of the seemingly random shooting victims were shot with a .44 caliber gun. They also state that the killer appears to be targeting women with long dark hair. This sends the city into a panic. Women begin dyeing their hair. Some women cut their hair, and many begin hiding their hair with a scarf. Gun sales go up, and the city is more on edge than ever. Virginia Volskirishin, age 19, is returning home after a day of college classes in the same neighborhood that Christine and John were attacked in. She is shot in the head at close range and dies instantly. She never even knew what hit her. 2 days after her shooting, police state publicly that they suspect her murder is tied to the murder of Christine Friend and to John's shooting. They tell the public that again, a .44 caliber weapon was used, and this time they add that the bullets are coming from a bulldog revolver. The public demands more police action, and police feel the pressure. Every day, the New York Post publishes an article about the killings. Some of the articles are more fiction than fact, but they feed the public fascination with the case, and they feed the fear. I think it's important to stop for a second and remember that we're talking about New York City here. This is one of the hubs for activity and information for the entire world. There is so much going on there at all times, and this killer, this one single man, took enough control over that huge city that people were talking about him at all times. In the city where so many crimes aren't even discussed, he was in the news, on the front page, every single day. That must have been intoxicating for him. It's just really quite something when you stop and think about how a single human being can have such great control and power over so many others. April 14th, 1977. The police authorities have admitted to themselves and to the public that the city is in the grip of a serial killer. However, that term had not yet been cemented in the minds of the public. Contrary to popular belief, Robert Ressler did not coin the term serial killer. He himself is actually the first to remind people of this. Dorothy B. Hughes actually uses the term serial killer in 1947 in her book called A Lonely Place. Other writers like Richard Hughes used the term serial killer or serial murderer several times in the 1950s as well, but it never sticks in the minds of the public until Robert Ressler, the famous FBI agent, begins using it in the late 1970s. So although neither the public nor the police have a label or a title for this type of killer, they know he is out there and they know he is responsible for all of these shootings. A task force called Operation Omega is formed and a very serious manhunt begins. They begin calling the attacker the .44 caliber killer, but that will soon change because, you see, the killer does not like that name and he decides to tell them what he prefers instead. But before he does, two more young people will lose their lives. April 17, 1977. Valentina Suriani, age 18, and her boyfriend, Alexander Isao, age 20, are sitting in Valentina's car near her home in the Bronx. They probably don't realize it, but they are actually sitting just two blocks from the site of the very first attack back in July of 1976. It is early in the morning, and a man walks up to the car and shoots both of them two times each. Alexander died at the scene. Valentina was taken to the hospital where she died hours later. This attack is like the others in so many ways, but for the first time, the killer leaves a handwritten note for the police. In the note, the killer calls himself Son of Sam, and he goes on to promise that the killings will continue. New York columnist Jimmy Breslin has been reporting on this case from the beginning. He writes an article informing the public of the note that has been left by the killer, in which he identifies himself as Son of Sam. Jimmy appears on talk shows day after day and becomes to the public kind of an expert on who Son of Sam is and what he might do next. Because of his reporting, he actually becomes involved in the case. June 1st, 1977. Jimmy Breslin receives a letter directly from Son of Sam. The day it comes into the newspaper office, Jimmy is not there, and the letter is actually opened by a secretary. She calls Jimmy and tells him what she's discovered. The letter reads in part, "Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I'm still here, like a spirit roaming in the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my world. Now the void has been filled." On the letter, Son of Sam draws a strange symbol that looks like this. The letter is signed, "In their blood and from the gutter, Sam's creation, 44. Jimmy told the secretary, "Call the police and give it to them." So she does. When the police see the letter and realize that Son of Sam is speaking directly to Jimmy Breslin, they start to form a plan to have him aid them in their manhunt. June 26, 1977. Around 4 in the morning, in Bayside, Queens, Judy Placido, age 17, and Sal Lupo, age 20, are leaving a disco. As they sat in Sal's parked car, a man approaches and shoots both of them. Judy gets out of the car, staggers up the street, and collapses in the middle of the road. Sal runs back to the Eliphas discotheque for help. He was just shot in the forearm. He alerts people in the club to the shooting, and they call the police. Judy is taken to the hospital for treatment, and both she and Sal survive the attack. The pressure on police increases as this attack occurred in a very quiet area. The public is demanding that the police do more, but they are already stretched to their limits. Tensions run high and families report a lot of infighting between teenagers that want to go out and enjoy their summer break and, you know, their parents who want them locked away safe at home. Just when it seems the tension cannot get any higher, one of the city's largest electrical transformers fails and New York City is plunged into darkness. This is straight out of a horror movie, right? The blackout causes even more fear in some New Yorkers, but others respond with anger and violence. Not long after the blackout hits, looting and rioting begins. The city is thrown into utter chaos. I watched a lot of historical footage and newsreels while I was preparing for this episode. There are hours and hours of police interviews and press conferences, and you can actually feel the stress that the police and the politicians are under. There's just shot after shot of rooms full of men on telephones, chain smoking, looking disheveled and exhausted. The crime, the angry New Yorkers, the unfulfilled promises to make change, and then the serial killer comes along, and to top it off, the city loses power. It was just kind of a perfect storm of pressure and chaos. July 31st, 1977. Robert Violante, age 20, and Stacy Moskowitz, age 19, are sitting in Robert's car in Brooklyn. They are out on their first date. Son of Sam walks up to their car and shoots both Robert and Stacy. Both are badly injured. They are rushed to the hospital. Surgeons had to remove one of Robert's eyes to save him, and his other eye is very badly damaged, leaving him legally blind. Stacy Moskowitz could not be saved. She died the next day. Stacy becomes Son of Sam's first blonde victim. Photos of the victims, which I would love to show you here, but I cannot, even though they're shown on the news, were released to the public, and people were absolutely horrified by the death scenes. The photos were shown to the public of just, you know, the damage these shootings were causing, and people were angry. Stacy is dying on a stretcher, and Robert is being wheeled into surgery, his face and head covered with blood. These images and these clips only serve to further inflame the public. At this point, New York City is spending $90,000 a day on the manhunt. There are 75 full-time detectives and 225 patrolmen working around the clock on this one case. They have investigated over 3,000 suspects. The Son of Sam hotline receives 2,000 calls a day. The parents of victims are in front of cameras pleading for justice and openly mourning the loss of their loved ones. Police were working thousands of hours of overtime. Each night, 85% of the task force works nights to stay on the lookout for the killer. Just when it all starts to feel especially hopeless, it happens. It doesn't happen with a heroic gesture. It doesn't happen with a bang. It happens because of an alert woman and a parking ticket. August 9, 1977. A witness named Cecilia Davis, living in the area of the Violante Moskowitz shooting, comes forward. She says she was walking her dog when she saw a man with what looked like a gun minutes before Stacy and Robert were shot. She also says, "When I saw the man with the gun, I also saw police officers walking through the area writing out parking tickets." Now, for some reason, Cecilia waited 4 days to come forward. She finally does come forward. Police immediately go to their parking violations files and search each ticket written on the day of the shooting. There, they find a ticket written to a man named David Berkowitz. And one of the officers says, "That guy's on the list of suspects. He's been harassing one of his neighbors who called, and she says she thinks he's Son of Sam." Yonkers police knew who David Berkowitz was because people found him weird, and they had brought his name up when talking about other crimes in the area. Some of those specific crimes had actually been mentioned in the Son of Sam letters. This is what led authorities to believe their killer might be Berkowitz. It might not sound like a lot now, but you can imagine how relieved they must have been to maybe possibly have a lead after a year of this. Police aren't sure they've got their man, but they've got more than they've ever had. The man Berkowitz fits the description of the suspect. They decide to find him. Police arrive here at 35 Pine Street outside of David Berkowitz's building. They see his car, a cream-colored 1970 four-door Ford Galaxy, on the street. There is a gun clearly visible in the back seat. The gun is enough legal cause to search the car. They open the car doors and find a duffel bag filled with ammunition, maps of the crime scenes, and a threatening letter addressed to Timothy Dowd, who is an officer working the Omega Task Force. The police then decide they should wait for Berkowitz to leave his building rather than go in after him to reduce the risk of violence and harm to other building residents. As they wait for him to come out, officers rush off to apply for a search warrant for the building. Around 10 p.m., Berkowitz comes out of his building and gets into his car. Detective John Falatico rushed to the driver's side of the car and pointed a gun right into Berkowitz's temple. Detective Sergeant William Gardella pointed another at him from the passenger side. After Berkowitz says, "Well, you got me," Detective Falatico says, "Now that I've got you, who do I got?" Berkowitz says, "You know." Falatico says, "No, I don't. You tell me." Berkowitz turns his head to look at the officer. He's smiling. He says, "I'm Sam." Falatico says, "You're Sam? Sam who?" Berkowitz says, "Sam, David Berkowitz." After a year and the largest manhunt in New York City, they had him. David Berkowitz was Son of Sam, and he was ready to talk. No matter how many times I see that clip, I am always unnerved by that smile. He looks obviously happy and enjoying the attention, no doubt. But there's this look of kind of confusion. Like, he doesn't really know what's going on. Like, he's not really grounded in reality, maybe. It's just unnerving for me. The search warrant is then carried out, and it reveals a chaotic Berkowitz apartment. There was graffiti on the wall showing religious and satanic symbols. They found diaries he had been keeping for years, many of them, actually. Berkowitz meticulously noted hundreds of arsons he claimed to have set all throughout the city. There were over 1,000 claims in the notebooks of separate fires. The mayor addresses the city. He tells its residents, "The people of the city of New York can rest easy because of the fact that the police have captured a man whom they believe to be Son of Sam." August 11th, 1977. Berkowitz is interrogated. He quickly and easily confessed to the shootings and said he would plead guilty. As he confessed, David said he had a neighbor named Sam Carr. Sam had a dog. David said the dog told him to start killing people. He told police the dog demanded the blood of pretty young girls. He said the dog, a black Labrador retriever named Harvey, was possessed by an ancient demon and that it issued irresistible commands to David and he had to follow them. Okay. David Berkowitz goes on to detail his claims that he is possessed by the devil. He writes a letter to the New York Post telling them that he is a demon. Now, we could talk about these claims for hours, but a lot of people actually believe that the era known as Satanic Panic that happened in the 80s kind of began in 1977 with Berkowitz claiming he killed because he was possessed by the devil. Berkowitz was put into a mental institution after his arrest and had been examined by several psychiatrists who said he felt like an outcast and he was angry at the world, but they said he was not insane and he was perfectly fit to stand trial. David Berkowitz tries to prove them wrong as he engages in antics like trying to jump out a window at the courtroom and screaming, "Stacy was a whore. I'd kill again. I'd kill them all again." His theatrics did not sway the opinions of the doctors who had spent time with him and had deemed him fit to stand trial. June 12th, 1978. David Berkowitz was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison for each murder to be served consecutively. On the day of his sentencing, he was taken to Sing Sing Prison and then to Clinton Correctional Facility. He was then taken to Attica, where he stayed for about 10 years. While there, Berkowitz was attacked by an inmate he has always refused to name. His neck was slashed and the wound required 50 stitches. He ended up in Shawanigunk Correctional Facility in Ulster County. David Berkowitz has since converted to Christianity and has become an evangelical. But that was only after the whole period of him blaming a satanic cult for his actions, saying other people were involved, other people made him do it, he wasn't the only shooter. We would need an additional hour to talk about that. There are people that believe Berkowitz didn't act alone, and that he actually was in a cult, and that others participated in the shootings. Like I say, there's kind of a lot of additional information that we won't be able to cover here today. David now asks that people stop calling him Son of Sam and start calling him Son of Hope. I hope he isn't holding his breath on that one. Or do I? I know how I'd feel if I was the parent of one of those kids. He comes up for parole every few years, but never really participates or requests to be released. He says he knows he is never going to be released, even though he tells prison officials, "I am no risk whatsoever." Well, yeah, I'm going to have to strongly disagree there. Who knows if he might run into like a pug or a chihuahua and, you know, they start talking to him again. David Berkowitz doesn't give many interviews. There are a couple, but we don't really hear from him much. He's right on one thing. He will never get out of prison. He's now a 67-year-old man, still sitting in a cell in upstate New York, right where he belongs. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I sure appreciate you. Thanks for watching. Thanks for giving me your time. If you haven't subscribed yet and you want to see more videos, please hit that button. Stay safe and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.